Welcome back, everyone, for another episode of Imagine Publicity on Air. We're partner sponsored by Wild Blue Press and Imagine Publicity. This podcast covers a variety of topics for you who are interested in current events, history, and books. I especially enjoy bringing attention to authors and books that you may not have heard of yet. Sometimes they're only popular regionally and just need a little bump to that I can provide through exposing to a national listening audience. And who am I? I'm the host, Delilah Jones of ImaginePublicity.com. We're a boutique social media management company that works with individuals, companies, or nonprofits looking for assistance with their social media presence. Not only do I offer full services, but also training to those who prefer to personally handle their own accounts. I appreciate your feedback. Please keep the suggestions coming. We have a lot of future episodes, and we want to give you what you want to listen to. So shoot me an email at Delilah@ImaginePublicity.com, or you can go through my website contact form at ImaginePublicity.com. Well, this brings us to today. Every true crime junkie in America is aware of the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer. Season one laid the backdrop of the murder of Teresa Halbach and the prosecution and conviction of Stephen Avery and his nephew, Brendan Dassey. But season two tells the other side of the story, where noted wrongful conviction attorney Kathleen Zellner got involved. She basically dismantled all the evidence, or the lack of the evidence, in the Avery case and exposed some very big surprises. And in his latest book, published by Wild Blue Press, Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery, John Farrick details much of what Zellner uncovered in Making a Murderer. Welcome aboard, John.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Can you give us a little bit of your background as far as, you know, what you've been doing that got you involved in this case in the first place?
Sure. I have 20, 25 years experience as a journalist. I grew up in Illinois, and I spent a number of years out in Omaha, Nebraska, working for the newspaper out there. And then it was end of 2012, so actually 6 years ago, is when I moved back to Wisconsin. I had been there before, and ended up on the investigative team for the USA Today network. And it was through that work, through that experience, that after Making a Murderer came out, that my editors had asked me to really try to dig into this case and just kind of go where the reporting, you know, where my investigative skills and instincts took me. And I really spent a good chunk of 2016 and 2017 really dissecting the Teresa Halbach murder case and really going through the court files on the case, and also doing my own research as far as trying to get a better understanding of Manitowoc County and the culture over there in the sheriff's department, because I really wanted to look at the case from a standpoint of, was the sheriff's department actually smart enough and intelligent enough to solve the Teresa Halbach case in a record fashion that they did, given the complexity of the case, that, you know, her body hadn't been discovered at the time of her disappearance, and just some other oddities as far as some of the evidence that ultimately turned up in the case and led to Stephen Avery's conviction, and that of Brendan Dassey as well.
Well, I think that what I found that was very fascinating about season one and the start of, or the background of this case, was the fact that Stephen Avery had been wrongfully convicted and spent 18 years in jail for a crime that he didn't commit. And he was very close to receiving a $36 million settlement. And how do you think all of that played into, you know, the next part of his story?
Well, that's an interesting point, Delilah. And just again to refresh our listeners here as far as the context and the timing of everything, the month of October of 2005 was a really stressful month for the people that worked actually at the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department. You had pretty much all of the high-ranking officials from Sheriff Kenny Peterson to Detective Jim Link to Sergeant Andy Colburn to a number of other individuals that listeners will remember from Making a Murder, such as Gene Couchet, the individual that drew the sketch of the rapist that looked similar to Steve Avery, but wasn't Steve Avery. It was really Gregory Allen. So again, the month of October was a really incredibly stressful month, and the other thing that had to be just galling and infuriating for the sheriff's officials is that when they were going to the law office in Manitowoc to give their lawsuit depositions in Steve Avery's $36 million lawsuit, who happened to be sitting at the table, you know, across from them amongst this room full of lawyers, and it's Stephen Avery. And in this situation, you know, he's got the upper hand. He's the one that's on the right side, and they're on the wrong side. So you have those factors at play. And again, this is the sheriff's department that was outright accused of corruption and framing him to begin with. And the evidence was pretty clear that they did. So isn't it also a possibility that if things were going to go worse for them as a result of this lawsuit and the possibility that some of these individuals would have to pay out of their own pocket any lawsuit settlement because the insurance company for the Manitowoc County government really was had stepped out of the case and had argued that that they were not liable for these. So you had a lot of things at play shortly before Teresa Halbach disappeared and before Steve Avery was arrested for the crime.
So it's right to say that a lot of the original players, when Stephen Avery was wrongfully convicted the first time, were also involved in this second case, correct?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Again, Kenny Peterson was involved in was instrumental in carrying out the arrest of Stephen Avery in 1985. 20 years later, he actually is the sheriff of Manitowoc County. And again, you also had a number of other people, too, that were still in the sheriff's department or were very loyal to the recently retired sheriff, Tom Kasorek, who had been in office for 20-some years and was also one of the key defendants whose family wealth and riches were on the line if this lawsuit continued. And Kasorek was just a matter of days out as far as that he was actually going to have to get pulled in the court and give his own deposition in the case. But that never happened. His deposition got canceled shortly after Teresa Halbach disappeared and after Steve Avery was arrested in real quick fashion for the crime.
So it would be reasonable to say that this whole law enforcement agencies in this county kind of had it out for him to begin with. It's very reasonable to look at it that way, of course. You know, whether you can prove it or not is another thing, but it certainly looks that way.
Right. And there's kind of that sentiment and that feeling, you know, among some in Manitowoc County that and I'm sure that's probably true in other parts of the country too, but where there's, you know, one family or two families in particular that seem to be singled out for ostracism or ridicule or the wrath of the local police department. And that certainly seemed to be the case over in Manitowoc County, Wisconsin, Delilah.
Well, I think the other thing that came out of season one, and I'm just kind of trying to lay a little bit of background here, just in case there's one person out there that isn't familiar with this, but I think the other thing that came out of season one was the Brendan Dassey interrogation and how that went. And you know, we might preface that in saying that Brendan was intellectually challenged, 16-year-old, as far as I know, had never really been in any trouble before. But the way that the interrogation was handled just seemed very wrong. What's your take on that?
I mean, it seemed to be the case where the two investigators on that interview seemed to be doing everything they could to manipulate him and kind of feed him the facts of the case, but do it in a way where it wasn't like your old school police brutality type of interrogation where somebody's, you know, being beaten, you know, or being, you know, hit with a switch or something like that. This was really more psychological manipulation of the individual, where it's pretty clear. And this is the other thing. The version of events that the police were trying to feed him, I mean, defies logic. I mean, the notion that somehow that Steve Avery was a premeditated monster and killer, and that he lured Teresa Halbach into his trailer, and that he's in the middle of a brutal sexual assault of her, having her tied up to his bedpost, and is in the process of killing her, and that there's a knock on his door, and it's his nephew bringing him some extra envelopes, mail that got put in the wrong mailbox. The notion that somehow that this would really happen, that Avery's going to walk down the hallway and see who's at the door and then notice it's his nephew, Brendan, and then invite him inside to participate in a premeditated attack like this. I mean, it's just crazy. And logical listeners on the show should be able to realize, you know, this is nonsense. So again, but that was the story pretty much that the police were feeding Brendan Dassey. And he eventually goes along and agrees with some of their assertions. And again, I've seen this in other cases around the country. So people that don't know anything about false confessions or really don't have a grasp of how they unfold, they would just look at Brendan Dassey's case individually and think, well, because he said it, it must be true. But I've had numerous other cases around the country where individuals that are of a lower mental intellect or have diminished capacity, they're often very prone and very vulnerable to these types of interviews and interrogations. And mentally for them, they just convince themselves that there's no way out, that they're trapped in that interview room, and that they really believe that if they just go along and say whatever the police or the detectives tell them to say or want them to say, that they actually believe that they get to go home, you know, at the end of the interview and stuff like that. And obviously in Brendan's case, as people may remember, I mean, after he got done with his interview, the first thing he asked them is if he could, like, go back to seventh or eighth period in school. So, again, this is clearly someone that was just going along and didn't realize the extent of, you know, what his statements were doing, that he was really helping the police, and that they were there to manipulate him because they really wanted to take Steve Avery down, and he could be one of Avery's alibi witnesses as the case was moving forward.
Well, and his testimony pretty much, you know, brought the hammer down on Avery because the jury apparently believed he was there, and this is what he saw. And, you know, one thing I've got to say is through all of this, whether anybody out there believes Avery did it or didn't do it, really, in my opinion, isn't the issue. I think the issue behind all of this is that we've gotten another look inside the justice system and how wrongful convictions come about. And I know you've done a lot of research and written another book about wrongful convictions. I've worked with clients who have handled wrongful convictions and exonerations, and that, you know, that's the greatest feeling, is when you can exonerate someone who has spent time behind bars. And most of these people were looking, you know, 10, 20, 30 years behind bars for things that they didn't commit. So it's an issue I feel needs to be discussed so that the general public is aware of it even more so. So we kind of fast forward to season two, and I think, you know, the opening of your book, it was a lot that I didn't pick up in the documentary. It was Teresa Halbach's background. There were a lot of things that you exposed in the book that really hadn't been brought out in the documentary. Would you like to just kind of go over some of these things so we get a better feel of how possibly she was in some precarious situations and not necessarily with Stephen Avery?
Right. And that's one of the things that that Kathleen Zellner and her law firm had, you know, really tried to do some research. And again, it wasn't to, besmirch Teresa Halbach or anybody else's reputation. It was just to do the investigative legwork that really was never done the first time around, Delilah, with the case. And most of the time, you know, as far as good police departments and experienced investigators, one of the things that they do is what's known as victimology, which is study the background of the individual that, disappeared and was murdered. And because oftentimes that leads to determining who the real killer is and figuring that out in quick fashion. Because most of the time people are killed by somebody they know, and not always. But again, with Halbach's case, she was also involved with a lot of, adult, sexually explicit type of, photography that she was doing at her at the photo studio in Green Bay, along with the other gentleman that ran the place. And this also became an issue right around the time that she died. She got pulled into a civil lawsuit involving a couple that were going through a divorce. It was a messy divorce, and she had taken nude photographs of them together posed at the photo studio before their marriage fell apart. And then the lawsuit was involving, getting access to these photographs. So shortly around the time that she disappeared, that was one of the first things the police did, was they were looking around, snooping around in her bedroom, trying to find these photographs. Because again, there was a possibility that maybe these photographs and maybe this divorce had something to do with her disappearance, because she wound up carrying on, and had a sexual relationship with the guy that was involved in the divorce and stuff. So there was all these factors going on at the time that Teresa Halbach disappeared, and these are and were legitimate avenues for the police, and certainly for Zellner, who's starting the case from ground zero, and has a knack, as she's pointed out before. She says that she solved, more murder cases, more homicide cases than many police detectives, and it's true. So when she's doing her investigation, she's trying to be thorough and try to determine whether or not some of the business prospects that Teresa Halbach was advertising and soliciting for online and on the internet, that maybe some weirdo or pervert or stranger had something to do with her disappearance.
Right. So, I mean, there were many other avenues that investigators could have taken rather than just putting the target on Avery's back. I mean, again, whether he did it or not isn't the question here. It's the lack of investigating other avenues and looking at other suspects, which kind of brings me to my next question is, let's talk about the suspect pool here. I think that was another thing in what Zellner has done, is she's widened the pool of suspects that were really never investigated and possibly didn't necessarily tell the truth about what they knew.
Right. And you had a number of individuals that to this day, are probably completely innocent, had nothing to do with the crime. But there's also a possibility that those same individuals don't want to cooperate with Zellner because they may have had a role as far as planting evidence or moving the vehicle, the RAV4, onto the Avery property. So there's those situations as well. But yeah, there was a number of individuals certainly draw suspicion and raise eyebrows. And you know, some of that starts back with back in Calumet County, where Teresa Halbach had shared a place, shared a farmhouse that was owned by her family, but she'd shared it with another guy, and yeah, one lived upstairs and she lived downstairs, I believe, or the other way around. But anyway, this is out in the middle of the country, and she disappeared on Halloween, so it's a Monday. And it's really not till Thursday, the 3rd, that that she gets reported missing. And the obvious question is, well, what was going on? This is during the work week. Teresa had made no plans to go on a vacation. There was no reason to believe she was, you know, gone out of state for a photo assignment or something like that. The obvious question is, why isn't the guy that that lived with her reporting her missing and or calling her family to let them know that she's missing? And along those lines, Teresa's ex-boyfriend basically stepped up to the forefront at the beginning of the case, and there were issues that apparently he had hidden it and didn't reveal to the police. He just identified himself as a concerned friend, but you come to find out later on that they had dated pretty seriously for about 5 years, and they broke up, and that Halbach, that Teresa really didn't want anything to do with him anymore, to the point where there was a wedding that she was going to be at that she didn't want him, you know, to be around and stuff. So, but nonetheless, you had him volunteering to take the lead on overseeing the search party efforts. He and the other guy wind up giving the camera to Pam Sturm and her daughter, and they're the ones that are going to show up on Saturday morning and go straight to the Avery Salvage Yard and just walk through the Avery Salvage Yard and immediately find the vehicle, and it's covered with tree branches, just all kinds of weird stuff there and stuff like that. So, again, you had those individuals. You also had another guy that that was on Teresa's route that that was very uncooperative, an older gentleman, mind you, but a fellow that lived out in rural Manitowoc County that was really strange and didn't want to cooperate with the police. So when they went to interview him in the first couple of days after Teresa disappeared, so and again, the ex-boyfriend that I talked about earlier that was involved in the nude photography that she got involved in a relationship with. So again, you had easily, you know, half a dozen other people that were in Teresa's life that were, you know, logical people, persons of interest, suspects. And that's not counting the people back in Manitowoc County, including Steve Avery, you know, including people in his family and immediate circle that that also warranted being looked at.
Let's go into that next, because I think, again, there's a few players right in his immediate family that would fit into this suspect pool that, you know, I think the importance of the suspect pool is not just to look at other people as possibility of committing this crime, but it also rules these people out. But if you've not properly investigated any of them, then you're not ruling them in or out. So it's all kind of stuck in limbo there. But I think it's very interesting, and I, you know, maybe we need to do a little short family tree here, where, you know, the Dassey brothers, who are the sons of Stephen's sister, am I playing
correct.
This correct? And then
yep,
her
right. Mm-hmm.
Second or third husband—I don't know which number husband he is. Scott
right.
Tadish. Go into a little bit of how, you know, these people in this pool here could possibly have something to do with it.
Well, you had again the Avery family used the Auto Trader photography services because they were, you know, they had over 4,000 vehicles, and they were oftentimes trying to sell some of the vehicles that they had on their property. And Auto Trader / Teresa Halbach was a regular out at the Avery property. So, again, they had familiarity with her. And it also made sense for the police to look at them and focus in on them because of the fact that she had disappeared, you know, from that, you know, from Avery Road. So it was logical that you'd want to look at different people that lived out there. And so you had Steve Avery, you had he had two other brothers that worked at the salvage yard, and then his sister had four children that were teenagers or as old as around 20 years old at the time, but that they were staying there or living there. And so it made sense that that they would be looked at as well. And the other thing that kind of would, I would say, would jump out from an investigative standpoint is that you had one of those individuals, one of Barb's sons, that that had come forward and basically said that he saw Teresa Halbach and was watching her from the distance, you know, around the same time frame that she disappeared. So that should that in my mind, you know, places him as a witness or a possible suspect, because again, he's pretty much come forward and is giving a statement that that he's observing her. Whereas you kind of know that just based on the time frame, that Brendan, the 16-year-old nephew, the one who's ultimately going to give a confession, I would say a false confession, to participating in the crime. I mean, he would have been at school at that time frame or riding the bus home along with one of his other brothers. So that pretty much takes out two of the brothers. And then the oldest brother of the four, I believe, was at work that day and or pretty much was staying at his girlfriend's house at that point in time. So he was, even though he was technically still at the family house, he really wasn't around very often and stuff like that. So, but you had the other nephew of Steve Avery, 19-year-old Bobby Dassey, who maintained that he was watching, you know, from the distance, you know, watching out out the window, you know, as Teresa Halbach pulled up to the Avery Road that Monday afternoon around 2:30-ish or so then.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Bobby Dassey a little more in depth. What in the initial investigation, how did that get handled as far as the investigators' interrogation of Bobby Dassey? How was that handled, in your opinion? And he eventually did testify, correct?
Correct. And I think the one thing that kind of sticks out at me is that they seem to go out of their way to constantly point out to him or remind him that they're not looking at him or don't believe that that he's involved in the crime. And it's clear that, but yet they have no reason to make that type of assertion or conclusion. In fact, one would actually say it's the opposite, that they should have looked at him from the get-go as a logical, you know, perpetrator, based on the fact that he was much closer in age to Teresa Halbach, and again, the fact that he was watching out the window should have been kind of a red flag for the police to really zero in on and then try to understand whether his statements that he was going to give made sense or whether they were just stories to try to get himself out of trouble and stuff like that. So, but again, with Bobby Dassey, he was 19 years old. He stayed at home and he worked the overnight shift, a late night shift at one of the local factories in Manitowoc County. When he's interviewed by them, he talks about how he had was driving on that he left the property shortly after Halbach was there to go deer hunting, he claimed, and he said this was his first time going deer hunting for the season, and he ultimately mentions that he had passed on the highway an individual that that would later become his stepfather. And that's that Scott Tadich that you had mentioned earlier, Delilah. So, but I thought that it was really odd, just some of the behaviors involving him and the fact that the police really were doing limited investigative techniques as far as with him and his property, even though this is a 40-acre property and the police were out there for over a week or so. They really didn't go into his garage, for example, until the very, very end of the case. by that point in time, Avery had already been arrested for the crime. So it was just kind of a walkthrough to see what was out there. But you had odd behavior by him, such as the fact that he had gone out about 3 or 4 days after Hallbuck disappeared, and by the time the police were starting to zero in on the Avery property, he went out and found a dead deer on the side of the road and then hung it up in his garage, which, again, would be a perfect thing to do if the garage may have been the location as far as where her body was cut up or mutilated. And, it would be a perfect cover to kind of throw the police off and stuff, because if they see a bunch of blood around and, they see a deer hanging up from the ceiling, their first thoughts are probably going to be, well, blood equals dead deer, when it could have just been a good cover-up for the crime.
Well, and I think, and it may have been just because technology maybe wasn't as good at the time of the initial investigation compared to Zellner's investigation, but doing a forensic examination of his computer, let's talk about that. I mean, I don't know. Bobby Dassey is kind of one of my favorite suspects as far as not being investigated far enough by any means. And I think this is a person who exhibits some behaviors that could or could not develop into something really dangerous. And whether there's an intervention needed or whether there's some kind of therapy needed for a person like this, it's kind of like you can't allow this type of personality to escalate. But talk about some of the things that were uncovered about Bobby Dassey, and then go into the timeline differences that, from what he claims he saw, he did, to what Kathleen Zellner was able to pull together.
Yeah, we had so it's February, and it's when Brendan Dassey gets arrested for the crime as well, and shortly thereafter, the police are going to get a search warrant to obtain the computer that was at the Dassey house, and that computer was pretty much used exclusively by Bobby Dassey, and that computer, there's going to be some interesting things that are found on it, but there's also going to be very interesting things that are not found on that computer, and that's the fact that that Zellner and her experts have been able to determine that there were several different periods around the time frame leading up to the crime here, the murder, but there were several different periods of time where the computer was reformatted or information was just completely wiped off the hard drive. And this is actually information that that one of Barb's I'm trying to remember. I think this would have been one of the half brothers of Bobby Dassey had come forward and given an affidavit along those lines. But basically, that Barb had hired some type of computer person to reformat and destroy evidence information that was probably incriminating regarding the case, but that this was wiped off the computer hard drive. And so the question obviously comes up right now then, Delilah, why would this happen to begin with? Why was Barb concerned, and what was on the computer that would prompt her to take those types of actions? And based on the information that Zellner and her computer forensic expert, Gary Hunt, were able to recover from those other periods that hadn't been wiped out completely, there was a number of incriminating and very disturbing images and keyword searches that were basically taking place around the time that only Bobby Dassey was home at the house, when he was, locked up inside the bedroom when nobody else was around. And that was some of these keyword searches that dealt with really looking at disgusting, hardcore, violent pornography, as far as just mutilation of bodies, people that have been, drowned or hit by cars. Those were the type of keyword searches that were taking place you know, with this computer that it appeared that only Bobby Dassey had access to. So there was this belief that Bobby Dassey was involved in this type of fantasy life, as one of Zellner's experts, I think Ann Burgess from the East Coast, has been able to determine. And this fantasy life had basically, you know, was consuming him and fueling his desires and his demons inside of his head. And some of these individuals, these images, apparently looked very similar, you know, to what Teresa Halbach looked like. And later on, we learn much more recently that there had also been, I guess, a couple of folders that were created on that computer, one for Steve Avery, I think one for Teresa Halbach, and I think a third one was labeled DNA for, like, you know, DNA evidence. And again, this is on the Bobby Dassey computer. This is not the Steve Avery computer. His computer was examined by the police, and they found no evidence at all of any type of violent, pornography. In fact, I guess he didn't even really use his computer that much. So again, all this points back to Bobby Dassey and the question of, you know, what was going through his mind, you know, what was he thinking about in the days and weeks leading up to Teresa Halbach's disappearance on the same day that we know, based on his own statement, that he's watching her, you know, from the distance outside of his window. And then he gives some of these unbelievable stories about how he's watching her. Then he decides to go take a shower, and then he's going to go deer hunting, which again kind of defies logic that if you're going to go deer hunting outside in Wisconsin, you know, why are you going to take a shower before you do that? That's usually something you would do afterwards. And then you put him, you know, in his van, you know, driving up Highway 147, and he claims that he's going to pass his future stepfather at the same time. And again, the area where that he claimed that they passed each other really, according to Zellner, doesn't seem to make much sense. And based on her analysis of his telephone calls, she basically thinks that he was in the same general area, that she could put him in the same general area where Teresa probably disappeared, which is off of one of the county highways over there.
Well, you know, it's old school policing, that this person had the motive and he had the opportunity. And it's just mind-boggling to me why they didn't hone in a little bit closer to either rule him in or rule him out as a suspect. And because it seems to me like a lot of the ingredients are there that would be a very viable suspect, and they definitely should have gone into that a lot deeper. So let's kind of compare theories. I think that's always interesting. Compare the theory of law enforcement and prosecutors as compared to Zellner's theory based on what she has found.
Well, you would have had law enforcement basically convincing themselves that Stephen Avery, and there was a lot, this is unbelievable, but it's true. You actually had a lot of police officers in Manitowoc County, and also even with the state of Wisconsin, and I know there was at least one regional FBI agent that didn't believe that he was innocent for the rape, even though the DNA evidence showed that he was. In fact, you had that Jean Couchet, who did the sketches, basically testifying that, police basically thought that maybe that DNA was mishandled or whatever. But so you had a lot of police that, even though 99% of the public realized Avery was a truly wrongfully convicted man for the rape, you still had a lot of police that refused to believe that, which tells you, I mean, what kind of people we're dealing with as far as that they don't even, you know, understand, you know, or comprehend DNA evidence. But they a lot of them were convinced that Steve Avery was, you know, was one of the worst monsters around, even though the evidence in his background really didn't show that. I mean, he had a few issues when he was in his early 20s that got him in trouble, as people from Making a Murder would remember. But nothing, you know, nothing that pointed to him being a, you know, sadistic monster, or that he was going around, you know, raping and killing multiple people. But yet that was the belief, and that was the mindset that the police had programmed into their own heads at the time that Halbach disappeared. And I think part of that was fueled by the fact that they also really wanted to get him. So I think the fact that they really wanted to get him, then coupled with their own belief that Steve Avery is a monster and that he would be the first person that would do this type of crime, I think that that's kind of how the case came together. The problem they had then was that a lot of the absence of evidence and absence of anything really pointing to Steve Avery as far as the crime happening in his trailer or in the garage really kind of threw them for a loop and made it hard to spin some of these unbelievable stories that were, told to the public and the community before the case actually went to trial. So again, he was basically convicted on a theory, or a tale, I would say, that was invented by the police and the prosecutor that Halbach was tied up, screaming for her life, begging for her life in his bedroom trailer, and that she was stabbed in there, and then that he would have manually carried her down the hallway, and taken her outside about 10, 15 feet away, and then put her on the ground in his garage, his detached garage, where she would have been shot with a shotgun, and then now that she's dead, that he would have moved her right behind the garage and stoked his fire and threw her into basically a bonfire on Halloween night, and that her body pretty much disintegrated except for a small portion of her bones. The biggest problem, though, with that, and I haven't talked about this yet, but it's probably one of the – sometimes could be the most overlooked facts of the case. It's one the prosecution really doesn't want to talk about, but that's the fact that some of her bones were not found in Steve Avery's burn barrel, but they were found about 60 yards away, and that was at the burn barrel that was commonly used by Bobby Dassey to cut up his dead deer and just other animals and stuff like that. So her bones were actually found in the Bobby Dassey burn barrel and not on the Avery property. Now, going along those lines, as we talked about, but Zellner's theory is that basically Bobby Dassey's obsessions with this violent, terrible pornography was really taking over his life, and that he wanted to act on that, and that he probably followed stalking Teresa Halbach that day, which would explain why he was watching her mannerisms and was able to give a real good detailed description to the police as far as what she was wearing compared to somebody that was just looking out the window at the mailman or letter carrier and really didn't make any observations. But in this case, he gave a very detailed description of her. So the belief is that he hopped in his vehicle shortly after she left the Avery property, and that he followed her for a short distance and was able to flag her down. And she would do what was pretty common around that area for photography, and that was what was known as hustle shots, which is a situation, where somebody either calls her or flags her down or just basically wants her to take a photo of something that they're selling usually. And that was a way for her to make extra money with Auto Trader. So again, if she had familiarity with Bobby Dassey or any of the Averys or Dasseys, he would not have been a stranger. He would not have immediately, put her on guard as far as that this is somebody dangerous or that my life's going to be, threatened here shortly. So again, the belief is, from Zellner's standpoint, that Bobby Dassey, waves her down and that she pulls over on the side of the road, and that they pull up the road a little secluded area that's called Cuss Road, where there's kind of a cul-de-sac at the end of it, and that when she was opening the back door for her RAV4 to get out her photography equipment, that's basically when Bobby attacked her and probably knocked her unconscious. And at that point in time, he may have dragged her off into the woods over there and assaulted her. But eventually the belief is that she was unconscious, and there's certainly blood marks on her vehicle that prove that. But again, Zellner's belief is that she was attacked from behind, and she was attacked with her back door open for the RAV4, and that explains why the blood is in the back of the vehicle, not because Steve Avery like lifted her dead body up and hoisted her into the vehicle after she was already dead by his garage. So again, completely different areas, completely different locations as far as where the crime may have happened. And Zellner's belief is that she was taken back to the property, but it was really that she was put inside of the Dassey garage, and that's where her body was probably cut up, and that she was later taken out to the quarries, not that far away, and that's where her body was burned in one of those burn barrels.
And okay, let's take it another avenue. Let's talk a little bit about Scott Tadish, who is the husband of Stephen's sister, Barb. What did we find out about him? He wasn't such a stellar guy either, right?
No, he's a real mean and nasty individual. In fact, I mean, when you compare his background and his lifestyle to Steve Avery, he makes Steve Avery look like a lamb or a sheep. You know, he's just a real ferocious monster who constantly flies off the handle, and has even done that in this case since Making a Murderer came out. Actually, he went on Twitter, around that time, and called Zellner, I mean, the worst names. I'm not even going to repeat them here on the show. I mean, people could track him down, or they're probably already aware of it. But it's some of the same things that I put in my book, where he gets on the phone with Avery and is talking about wanting to put him in the ground, and he's going to bury him, you know, under the dirt and stuff. But Scott Tadish has had a long history of abusing women, being violent to women, even attacking his own mother, and numerous arrests in the 1990s, especially, you know, for showing up at his ex-girlfriend's place in the middle of the night and threatening her and then beating up her boyfriend. And these were just common traits and common behaviors of Tadish. And again, you put him involved in as far as with Teresa, the one thing that he had that everybody else pretty much didn't have was that he worked at an aluminum foundry, you know, which had very hot, you know, ovens where things were burned there. And there was suspicion amongst the people that he worked with that perhaps Teresa Halbach's remains or some of her remains may have been burned or incinerated at that foundry. And there was even a weird, strange note that was sent to the police that talked about an aluminum smelter, and it was written by somebody that was believed to be illiterate. And again, the police never really followed up on this at the time of the crime, but a lot of people at work suspected that maybe the letter was written by Scott Tadish, because the letter was signed S-I-K-I-K-E-Y, which was, you know, Sicky, but I guess Scott Tadish's nickname at work was Skinny. So again, very close as far as the letters and stuff like that go. And again, he put himself basically out in the same general area where this crime happened by the fact that he skipped work that day on the day of the crime, which is another, you know, issue of concern. He was never interviewed either, Delilah. He was never interviewed about his own whereabouts on the day of the crime. He was interviewed, you know, weeks later about the case, but it was really not in the context of a suspect, but it was just more or less the police were really trying to see if they could get him to be helpful to them to nail Avery as far as the bonfire that was behind his house. So Tadish recognized that he could really get himself out of, you know, trouble here and be a helpful witness to the police and the prosecution, you know, if he just kind of went along with the program, you know, and told them that this fire was just unbelievably hot and it was super high, you know, when he was over at Barb's place that Halloween evening.
Well, all of this conversation leads me to the conclusion that there were a lot of people that should have been investigated further, that very well could have had something to do with this even more so than Stephen Avery. And yet, you know, obviously they honed right in on Avery, forgot about all of this other stuff going on. And what's their reaction now that Zellner has been able to uncover a lot of this, and it's been exposed not only through season two, but also through your book? I mean, you've got a lot of good information in there, and I really encourage everyone listening that has interest in this case to get a copy of Wrecking Crew, because you lay it out so well. The details are so well laid out in this case that really make you think about what really happened.
No, thanks, Delilah. I really appreciate that. Since I'm in Illinois now versus, you know, being in Wisconsin, I'm not, you know, on the ground, so to speak, as far as what reaction there is back in Manitowoc or Manitowoc County. But I could tell you, just based on the few years that I spent up there where I was constantly in Manitowoc County, you know, as I was writing these hard-hitting investigative stories for the USA Today Network and also being there, you know, in wake of Making a Murder coming out, typically typically kind of how things worked over there as far as the powerful people in that community, and that would include the police, the sheriff's department, city leaders, county officials, and the business community kind of all rallied together and kind of put together, you know, kind of a talking points for each other and stuff like that. In fact, I did a story a couple of years ago how they actually had solicited and worked with a public relations firm out of Washington, D.C., that had helped some police departments in wake of the, you know, the national outrage that came, you know, over in Ferguson, and also with the death, that one suspicious, mysterious death that happened over in Baltimore with the guy over there. So again, there was a PR firm that actually had put together a bunch of talking points, you know, for the Manitowoc County and Calumet County sheriff's officials. We give them advice on how to handle, you know, the press and the public and kind of what to say. And again, some of these people I've seen, you know, it seems like they're just a bunch of robots, and that tells you that they're programmed to say, you know, what they're saying and stuff like that. They really don't mean it. And one thing that I constantly noticed was that Brad Schimmel, who just got beat a few weeks ago as the Wisconsin Attorney General, who was a complete deadbeat as far as, you know, really looking at the case from the standpoint of Brendan Dassey. When Brendan Dassey's conviction was overturned, Schimmel's first thing to do was to fight it. And he spent thousands of dollars, you know, and staff time trying to do whatever he could to keep Brendan Dassey in prison, which he ultimately succeeded in doing, even though there was two federal courts that ruled that Brendan Dassey's conviction should be overturned and thrown out. So it'll be interesting to see how things go now that there's a Democrat in office. It's Scott Walker, who was also another individual that really didn't look into this case and want to give it a review. I mean, he got beat as well. So again, there's new people that are going to be in office. Whether that'll make a difference remains to be seen. But again, there's at least some optimism amongst the public that maybe now that there's some new people in the governor's mansion and also in the attorney general's role, that that maybe people will wise up and look at the case again. And that's actually what happened in Nebraska in the case I wrote my last book on back in 2016, the Failure of Justice book. And that was actually a situation where you had Republican conservatives. They set up a task force to reexamine the original murder of Helen Wilson, where six people went to prison for that crime, three men and three women, under a theory that this older woman was the victim of a gang rape in her little apartment. When the facts of the case, as an FBI profiler had put together, determined that this was a crime of opportunity, that this was a rapist that was lurking around the community and committed this type of crime. And you had the state of Nebraska took this case, they gave it to a new police agency, set up a task force, and that agency ultimately came up with the theory that, yeah, one person was involved, and lo and behold, they later found that the DNA evidence pointed to one man that had committed this crime, and all six of the people were innocent. And even though there was outrage and a lot of confusion, a lot of people back in the town that this happened, after the press conference, after the pardons were given, you know, after the six were set free, the politicians in Nebraska said the most important thing to them wasn't keeping this false narrative going, but it was doing the right thing. And you got to applaud them for doing that. And whereas if you look at Scott Walker and Brad Schimmel, their legacy on this case, you know, will always, they were just kind of towing the company line and just saying, you know, that Avery was guilty and Brendan Dassey was guilty. But I know deep down in my heart that those guys they don't know the case. They really don't know if Avery is guilty or Bobby or Brendan Dassey's guilty because they haven't studied the case. Whereas at least in Nebraska, the governor and the attorney general really took the case apart and found the opposite had happened and stuff like that. So again, you have a lot of people in denial back in Wisconsin, especially around Manitowoc County. You know, that again, I wrote a story a couple of years ago about how the county board chairman, a guy named Jim Bray, had written an email after Making a Murderer came out. And he actually told the other county officials in the sheriff's department, hey, don't worry, I got your back, basically, you know, that this series is garbage. But he also put in his email, he said that the minute he saw Steve Avery being led into the courthouse after he was charged with murder, he said that left him convinced by looking in Avery's eyes that this was a guilty man. And like I said, these are the kind of people that Manitowoc County keeps electing and putting in the power. And it's just unfortunate, but that's just the reality that they live in, Delilah. So go figure.
Exactly. Well, you know, again, one of the, I think the best things that has come out about this is the fact that it's exposing prosecutorial misconduct and corruption in law enforcement agencies and in politics. I mean, who knows how far up the chain it really goes. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have time to go into Ken Kratz. That's a whole other show, I think.
Right.
He really needs to be looked at.
For April or March or something like that. How's that sound?
That sounds wonderful. I would love to delve deep into him. That's one crazy dude. But anyway, now that we're winding down and running out of time, I thank you so much for writing this book and the companion piece to Making a Murderer in my book. And I think that if anybody can bring justice, I think this is the crux of it. It's not so much getting someone exonerated or getting someone convicted. It's getting to the truth. And that's the only place that true justice is going to be found, is in the truth of the evidence. And I applaud Kathleen Zellner for taking this on and doing such a great job. So tell everyone where can they get a copy of Wrecking Crew, and how can, if you want to be contacted, how can people contact you?
I was going to say along those lines, and timing is great actually for this, because last night, Kevin Pierce, who's our narrator, who does a lot of fabulous true crime books as far as on Audible, but he had just released our audio version of Wrecking Crew. So people can go on Amazon right now and actually acquire the audio book version, which I know is going to be super popular, because I had people from around the world, actually a lot of people from overseas, have been contacting me for the last couple of weeks or so since Wrecking Crew came out, asking how can they get an audiobook version. So that's out there too. So, but again, short and simple, the easiest way to find Wrecking Crew is just to go online, just to go to Amazon, and there's three versions of it. There's the paperback version, there's the Kindle version that people can download, which is probably the most popular, and then now there's the audiobook version. And they could also find it as well by just going to wildbluepress.com, where they could find it as well. And they could also look at other collections of books, through numerous other Wild Blue Press authors as well. So that's the short and simple place to find it. And as far as just people need to contact me or want to track me down, I think the easiest way, frankly, to do that is just to go to my website, which is johnferrick.com. And they could just drop me a line or send me a message that way and stuff like that. But again, I'm also on Twitter, and that's another popular spot as well. So just track me down or follow me there as well. I know I've been picking up a lot of followers ever since Making Murder Part 2 came out, and I know a lot of people around the world. It really surprised me, actually, Delilah, but I'd say probably at least 30 to 35% of the initial sales that we got for the book were coming from the United Kingdom and also Australia and New Zealand. There's really a lot of worldwide interest in this
case. That is interesting. Wow. Well, good. Good. The message is going global. That's what you want. Again, thanks a lot, John, for being with us. And till next time, please go out there, be safe, but most importantly, be kind to each other.